Patrick Smirley. Kia ora, welcome.
Kia ora, Catherine.
Patrick is the editor and co-founder of Business Desk and has reported on the New Zealand economy and business since the 80s, which was when we last had scary inflation, and we'll come to that a little bit later because there's some nerves, obviously, about the direction at the moment, or we're a long way off where we were back then. Let's start, please, with Fonterra, Patrick, and I'm pleased to talk about this because I haven't... And perhaps it's good news that we haven't heard so much about Fonterra as we were hearing, say, 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, Fonterra is a very complicated thing to talk about when you get into the weeds of what they're actually doing with their capital structure and so forth, which is where this conversation unfortunately needs to go. But at a very high level, it's fair to say, I think over the last 6 or 7 years, Fonterra was doing a fantastic job of destroying capital by trying to build an international business that owned milk pools and milk processing activities around the world under the previous chief executive, Teo Spierings. And that when Teo left and he was replaced by Miles Hurrell, a local who had come up through the ranks, if you like, of Fonterra, basically took another tack, which was to say, we're going to just concentrate on getting value out of New Zealand farmers' milk. We're going to start selling assets around the world that haven't worked out for us and just kind of clean house and make this a simpler business. It may not be as big, it may not be as exciting looking, it may not be as global, but it should be more profitable. And he's been doing a pretty good job of that. And we've seen a lot of clean out of assets which weren't working well for Fonterra, and with some more to come. I mean, they're now talking about possibly floating their Australian assets and selling off the assets that they've owned since the early 2000s in South America, which have never really worked for them at all. Unfortunately, into the middle of all of this, though, they've introduced a new capital restructuring plan, which is complex to explain, but at the highest level, what you can say is that, unfortunately, since it was announced in May, it's wiped a couple of billion dollars, probably more than that, off the value of farmers' shares in Fonterra. And notwithstanding the fact that that's happened, it seems almost inevitable to me that because of the way that Fonterra farmers think about Fonterra and that New Zealand has approached the cooperative, they will probably not face any penalty or commercial discipline for having done that. It just seems to be an endless process with Fonterra of clinging so completely to the idea that the cooperative and farmer control is the only way for this business to be owned, that the question of its performance is always a secondary consideration, and that seems to be what's happening again with this latest capital structure proposal.
Giles tried to explain on the day that was announced back in May, and he did a very good job of it, the essentials of the restructuring.
Would we get him in?
Yeah, no, we won't do it again. I'm just recalling there were a range of options. There was dual share structures to allow some outside involvement, splitting the co-op between supply and processing businesses, different classes of shares. So it was very complex. We used to talk about the A and B shares, didn't we? Is that still relevant?
What it really boils down to is that the reasons for setting up the Fonterra Shareholders Fund, which allowed non-farmers to have some exposure to Fonterra's income streams, has dissipated over the last 10 years. So it was first set up to help farmers who wanted to be able to get in and out of Fonterra by creating some liquidity in the market for Fonterra shares. That need for liquidity is somewhat dissipated because the general feeling now is that New Zealand is at peak milk. There's not going to be a whole lot more milk created. If anything, probably be less milk produced in New Zealand over the next 10, 20 years just because of the environmental factors, and maybe there aren't that many more places you could actually farm dairy. So that reason's gone. A desire not to lose market share, and there's always this fear of influenced by outsiders, which seems to drive a lot of the thinking behind the cooperative mindset. And, you know, a long time ago, in one of my brief sojourns outside of journalism, you know, I worked in Fonterra when it was first set up. And I was really struck then by the fact that there's this thing called the cooperative mindset that you have to almost believe in an almost religious way that the cooperative is the only decent way to set up the Fonterra organisation. And if you take that view, then what that's going to do is mean that farmers are only ever going to be interested in what they paid for their milk at the farm gate. And that's fine if you own a farm, and obviously that's what you're going to think about. But those farmers don't have the capital resources or the commercial incentives in that setup to think about how to make Fonterra a very profitable company. And the result of that is that our largest company, our only company of global scale, remains hogtied 20 years on by the fact that it can't access external capital without creating a whole bunch of what to me seem to be existential but not particularly commercial fears about who owns it, when who owns it should be, I would have thought, less important than how good a job does it do.
Well, actually, if you're a farmer, less important than what's the bottom line return I get, because that is the point. It was given special legislation, remember, to become basically a monopoly. There's tiny, relatively comparatively tiny players in the field next to it, although growing in number. But the whole point of that legislation was so that the cooperative could continue, and it could continue to be owned by farmers. My question to you is, if there's, what was the journey, to quote John Mitchell back in the rugby day, to use the rugby parlance, what was the journey that they went on with Tao Spearings when it came to, you know, we're going to have this big international company, we're going to have these joint ventures all over the place? What is it that you see it being constrained by now that wasn't explored during his era?
I think the strategy that Tao followed had a certain logic to it, and if it had been successful, it would have been a wonderful thing. They would have owned a whole lot of milk in other countries. They would have been a much bigger player in the international dairy market than they are now. I mean, New Zealand is in the funny position of producing a lot of milk that it doesn't drink or use itself. Most countries aren't like that. So we are sort of a swing producer for the export market, but the export market for dairy products isn't that great. And Fonterra legitimately, and the New Zealand dairy industry legitimately needs to think about how it positions itself internationally in order to both make money in that circumstance, but also perhaps to some degree to try to control peaks and troughs of global shortages and oversupply of milk. For whatever reason, we could talk about it for hours, that didn't really work. They poured billions of dollars into various activities, particularly in China, which were very unsuccessful, and which they basically concluded after Tao had gone that they needed to pull back from. And that they have been rewarded for to some degree, because the balance sheet's in better shape, earnings are in better shape, the strategy is easier to understand. It's certainly, I would have thought, better supported by New Zealand farmer shareholders, because it basically concentrates on their milk. The problem is that having destroyed several billion dollars worth of farmers' capital going offshore, we now seem to be in a situation where the farmers being asked to vote and support a capital restructuring proposal, which simply by its being announced has dropped the Fonterra share price to such an extent that farmers are another $2 billion down the hole.
So you believe the act of announcing the restructuring has caused the value destruction. What would have been another way of doing it?
That I'm not qualified to tell you. I'm sorry, but all I can say is that the restructuring was announced on May the 6th or thereabouts. The Fonterra Shareholders Fund and share price, which usually moved in lockstep, have moved apart. And at its lowest point, the price of a Fonterra share across the whole shareholding base was about $2.8 billion.
Now I understand it. So the restructuring has destroyed the interest, I guess, in investing in that fund. But you've also said that the need for the fund, which was liquidity, is also disappearing. So it's almost like the emperor has no clothes, maybe, with the fund, and that's why we're seeing the value destruction.
think it's partly to do with just probably liquidity, that it's difficult to know in the future who is, it's not difficult to know. It's obvious that there will be far fewer people able to buy Fonterra shares in the future or economic interests in Fonterra, because only Fonterra shareholder farmers will be able to trade amongst themselves.
Look, it's a moment of reckoning however you look at it, isn't it? And is the real problem that it's taken this long to sort out then?
I think this is a personal view. My personal view is that the real problem is that the cooperative structure creates strange commercial incentives from the perspective of Fonterra as a milk processor. The incentives are not strange from the perspective of the farmer, because the farmer wants the best possible return at the farm gate. But the farmer doesn't have the capital to put into Fonterra to go up the value chain, which they talk
about. Which is the biggie, It's long been
and which they haven't really been very good at doing.
Yeah.
And which actually other cooperatives have been successful at doing. I mean, the one that gets talked about a lot is Kerry in Ireland, which has a similar story, but a much, much greater value creation story. So, I mean, I know it's easy to sit here and take pot shots at Fonterra and then say, I don't know what the answer is. All I would say is that until Fonterra works out how it can attract capital that is not farmer capital and be incentivized to get maximum value from the milk that it processes, it's always going to be in this conundrum where farmers are relatively happy with what they get at the farm gate, but the company never produces the wealth that it could for New Zealand if it were to some degree set free from that level of farmer control.
Yep.
Farmer control is holding Fonterra back. That's not something that a lot of farmers would necessarily agree with, because it's not in their economic interest to take any more risks than they currently take.
It's a problem wrapped up in a conundrum wrapped up inside of a paradox. I can't remember how that role runs out.
I've probably made a really bad job of trying to explain.
No, you haven't. You haven't at all. It just really is. It is a pivotal moment, and one bit we haven't got to, and you alluded to it, is what is going to happen to demand for milk as the environmental pressures continue to mount, and as food alternatives, including milk alternatives, you know, you've got your oat milks now, you've got your all the nut milks, etc. It's difficult to map what its journey is going to be. Your point about the value chain has been made by commentators for years, that commodities and raw milk or processed milk powder is not a profitable future for the company. But you also make the point it's difficult to go up the value chain without investing and using capital to invest, and then you cycle back and say, but what's the incentive for the farmer? The incentive for the farmer ultimately is returns on two fronts. Yes, the farm gate price, but also returns as the primary and the major shareholders of Fonterra. We're a value-added endeavour to succeed and to make their way back to farmers' pockets, then they may look differently on that. The problem was they were sold a vision that did not deliver the bottom line. In fact, it did anything but.
And when it comes down to it, if you are a dairy farmer, you're producing rivers of milk at this time of the year. You want to know that it has a market or that somebody's going to buy it. And Fonterra definitely gives you that. Or whoever you sell it to. And you also know that a lot of it's going to end up being exported, and the only profitable way to export it is as milk powder. So because there's so much of it. So the whole business of making and drying milk remains at the core of the farmer's interests for Fonterra, and that's, could argue, inimical to some extent to the pursuit of value up the value chain, because the dried product is ultimately the easiest use of the large volumes of milk which New Zealand produces and doesn't drink at home.
Interesting. Some two decades on from when all this happened, of course, with the formation of Fonterra. Now let's talk about this next challenge facing employers, how to deal with the unvaccinated. More and more and more are dipping their toes in the water of, certainly with workers saying, you need to be vaccinated to come to work. Visitors, clients, contractors, one of the big law firms, I think, over the past week I've seen is no one's coming on site if they're unvaccinated. There's two parts to the story. One is what that does to your, what impact that might have either on key staff making decisions, or more likely key clients making decisions. And then the second point is their fears, many businesses' fears that all this is going to end up in court. How are you reading it?
I'm not sure that they are right to fear that it'll end up in court. It may well be that some people will try to take it to court, but I think, you know, if you look at the one court case that has been taken, which admittedly relates to customs workers, so somebody at the border who tried to challenge their dismissal after there was nowhere for them to do a job if they weren't vaccinated, that was not upheld. So the courts are already starting to side with the idea that if you need to be vaccinated and you don't want to be or can't be, then, and there's no other job for you to do, then that is grounds for being let go. So that's helpful. The mandates that the government's announced for not only border workers but also health workers and education workers are as far, I think, as the government's prepared to go, because they know that if they push this out to everybody, there will be a big civil rights debate. A whole lot of people will be very angry. A whole lot of other people will probably protest. And in the end, the government takes the view that this is a problem for employers to sort out. It's a kind of an unusual reversal where employers are seeking regulation and the government's saying, not on your nilly. What I do think is likely to happen, though, is in the next few weeks, we'll probably see some amending legislation which will be added to the COVID legislation, which is going through the House at the moment, which will give some comfort to employers to say, basically, while this pandemic remains active, and, you know, all of this COVID legislation has a use-by date, it stops at a certain point or has to be renewed if the thing's going on. During that period, you will be able to regulate your staff and your employees, people on site and so forth, on the basis of a health and safety consideration rather than a health consideration. So that if your health and safety policy says we want everybody to be double vaccinated, irrespective of whether they're staff or a visitor or a contractor, you will be able to do that. What the government won't do is go the extra step and make that a mandated law. They just simply say, if you are an employer and you make that decision, you will be able to do that. And I think we'll probably see an increasing number of firms starting to move in that direction already. You know, those couple of firms that we saw last week, Russell McVeigh and PwC, they were just at the bow wave. It's almost broken a bit of a dam. People are starting to say, okay, we clearly need to do something in this area, and are beginning to do so. One of the interesting pieces of advice, I think I'm getting this right, from senior health and safety leaders is to say, don't spend a whole lot of time in your business doing a big risk assessment as to who is most likely to get it or who's most at risk. And if you're all in the same building, you're probably all breathing the same air, whether you're front of house or back of house. So basically, you should assume that everybody is at risk, and that probably most people in New Zealand will be exposed to Delta sometime in the next 6 months or so anyway. If that's the case, then the most important thing is to think very carefully about how you implement the policy that you're proposing to implement. Talk to your staff about it. Get some buy-in. Don't sort of monolithically impose something, but on the other hand, be clear about what it is that you're trying to achieve, because in many, many cases, it would be quite difficult once you've decided that you do want double vaccination throughout your workforce to have people who aren't vaccinated on site. But you may be able to accommodate a lot of roles working from home or working offsite. But I think it's just going to become normal while the pandemic continues to run its course that double vaccination is expected.
Let's talk about the bounce back from, in inverted commas, from lockdown whenever it ends, and another 2 weeks now for Aucklanders, in a sense. I think the Prime Minister was this morning being upbeat about Christmas anyway, being mm-hmm. outside of this situation, but it is unknown how many more weeks now Auckland is in this situation. When we talk about bounce back, how are you reading things compared to previous situations? And then we'll talk about the inflation pressures and their relevance as well.
I mean, it's a bit impressionistic, but the sense I have is that two things are happening. One is that when we bounced out of lockdown last year, we were still in a very optimistic frame of mind about elimination and New Zealand's achievements. as we come out of lockdowns on this occasion, we're basically having to face the frustrating reality that we're going to go pretty much like the rest of the world. The only thing we've got going in our favour is that we are much, much more vaccinated than anybody was this time a year ago. So we can get through it a bit more quickly and hopefully without the same level of hospitalizations and deaths. But in terms of public mood and sentiment, it's just not that buoyancy there. The other thing is a lot of small businesses, even though they've had a lot of government assistance, those which have been forced to close or to trade in a limited fashion over the last few weeks, every week that goes by, it becomes that much more difficult to continue to do so, that much more personal debt, that much more putting your house on the line, that much more uncertainty as to whether you can keep on your current level of staff. And so, you know, another two weeks in Auckland is material to a lot of those businesses. If it were another 6 weeks, it took us through to early December, every week that goes by is a bit more difficult for many of those businesses. Now, I think what we will see is a bounce back. But if it's a bounce back in the first quarter of next year rather than the first quarter of this year, there will be quite a number of businesses that aren't participating in that. Now, does that matter to the business owners? Of course it does. To the wider economy, you know, we're at full employment. So if you lose your business, you're still probably going to be able to find a job. I know that's not particularly great news or anything like that, but it's a buoyant economy for those parts of the economy that are working. But I do think it's going to be a tricky time through to Christmas, and that as we go into the new year, the one thing that may just take the edge off is the fact that interest rates are going to be rising by then, and these inflation figures we saw this week suggest that.
How do you read what the Reserve Bank's response is going to be to that inflation figure? There's a big debate as to whether you keep looking through this, even if it's 1 or 2 years, especially the supply side stuff. We also saw food prices having a big impact yesterday, and a one-off on was it rates increases as well fed in to that still shocking result to many of close to 5% already. So how do you read the Reserve Bank assessing things from here?
Look, I think what the Reserve Bank is trying to do is to take its foot off the accelerator rather than put its foot on the brake, but that it'll be taking its foot off the accelerator more emphatically than it had been when it looks at these latest numbers and the possibility of another very strong quarter in the December quarter. So if it were to move significantly on interest rates, you could start to see finally, I mean, I think the first time in a decade I'd be prepared to suggest, well, I think I might have been thinking this way for a wee while, that, you know, the Reserve Bank actually wants house prices to fall a bit. You know, Adrian Orr's not saying house price inflation is unsustainable. He's saying house prices are unsustainable at their current levels. And the reality for anybody who currently owns a good chunk of or all of their house is that if house prices were to fall even 30% from today's level, which I'm not suggesting they're going to, they would still be worth about what they were worth 9 months ago, because the house price inflation in New Zealand has been so extreme in the last couple of years that a bit of a knockback wouldn't affect anybody really, apart from those who are very heavily leveraged and recently bought a home.
Thank you, Patrick. Much appreciated. Patrick Smalley, editor and co-founder of Business Desk.